Kelly asked me to make this announcement. Andrew Young is coming to St. Paul. I don't know if a lot of you know who Andrew Young is. He's one of the leaders in the civil rights movement from Georgia. A very prominent politician. I think was in the Georgia House. But anyhow, he's coming and speaking on Sunday, April 23rd. And a highly respectable figure in the context of his course in the civil rights revolution since the 50s, he'd be an important person to listen to. So, okay. Well, we're in the dark, so doesn't mean we have to be intellectually in the dark. Friday, we've got the test. That'll be on material from the beginning to where we finish today. And don't forget your readings in Bennett and in Fraser. And that material would go again to the end of the Reconstruction period. No, just the final is from there, from here, from here on. We won't retread it. And on the final, I'm going to give you a series of questions to prepare. Okay, and then we'll pick from that. As far as the period of Reconstruction is concerned, that's the immediate period right after the Civil War. Or that would go then from 1865 to the close of Reconstruction, which usually in our history we put as being 1877. Now, I think without a doubt, one of the keys to American history overall is this period, and most specifically for the fortunes of the African American, it's most fundamental in terms of what happened and what happened subsequently, even down to today. Now, we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but I'll just give you a real quick sketch of some of the key events in the period of Reconstruction, which might aid a little bit in understanding. Okay, the Civil War, as you know, goes from 61 to 65. Now, about halfway through this war, 1863, at that point, the reason for fighting that war in terms of national politics was merely to preserve the Union. At that point, Lincoln could not yet say, preserve the Union and free the slaves. The reason why that could not be done politically is many of the states who did not secede still had slavery. That would be the border states, like Missouri and Tennessee and Kentucky and Delaware and places, Maryland, places like that. There's a really constitutional protection for property at that point, and Lincoln couldn't free all of the slaves, even those in the states which had not seceded. Politically, that would have been impossible. So it's a war for the Union. However, as you know, in 63, Lincoln has the Emancipation Proclamation as a war measure, which frees the slaves, which on January 1st of the next year are still behind rebel lines. Those are free, not those who are still in areas controlled by the Union. He couldn't free them. But as a war measure, where they're under slavery and you still have rebels controlling them, they are free. Okay, but what happens then from 63 to 65, the Civil War becomes a radical war. Radical in the sense that it is not only a war to preserve the Union, but also in order to preserve the Union, the slave will also be free. So that's your situation then when the Civil War parts of Arkansas and other areas like this. Now, what he says is, in those states, when 10% of those who voted in 1860 say that they are loyal to the Union, that state then can come back into the Union. And that happened with a number, like Louisiana, for example, and Tennessee, which was reconquered at that point. So Lincoln's measure in 63, in the middle of the war, was very lenient in terms of the future for seceded states. Okay, the Civil War is over in 65. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, you know, just a few days after the surrender of Lee. Then the new president is Andrew Johnson, who now becomes president. Johnson was a Southerner from Tennessee who had remained loyal to the Union, was a Democrat of the opposite party of Abe Lincoln, and himself had been a slaveholder at one point, but himself was sharply anti-slavery at this point and was anti-rebellion. Now what happens is things work differently at this point in our history. The Congress was not in session from July of 65 until the end of that year, 65. Congress is not in session. So Andrew Johnson then is going to have presidential reconstruction. Presidential reconstruction of Johnson follows pretty much Lincoln's plan and is very lenient and very liberal. So, when he's going to exclude high officials in the Confederacy from coming back or having a vote, but over against Southern seceded states, very lenient, when they simply vote for loyalty, repudiate their Confederate war debts, they can come back into the Union. So they do. But what happens during that period? What Johnson did is, over against Southern plantation owners who had vast tracts of land, who had lost it during the war, he has a very liberal pardoning policy and says any white landowner who comes and asks for pardon, he gives them pardon. So all summer and fall, ex-Confederates are coming to the White House asking for pardon, and Johnson pardons them. Okay, so what happens then is, their confiscated lands are given back to them. Now watch that. What that means is a lot of ex-slaves who are now freedmen who have this land and think it's their land no longer have control of that land. Okay? Then another thing that happens is Southern whites, with their tradition of being masters and mistresses, are rather harsh in terms of suppression of the freedmen. They're freedmen now. They're no longer slaves. What they have is, and this angers the North very much, what are called slave codes. These slave codes pretty much follow a lot of the rigidities that you had under slavery. So a slave is a freedman, yes indeed, but there are all kinds of legal restrictions placed upon them. One of them that really angered a lot of Northerners were vagrancy laws. If there is now a freedman who is seemingly not having a permanent kind of a position, they then can be, under vagrancy laws, hailed into court and then kind of farmed out to landowners who will put them to work. So they are no longer vagrants. That angers the North. then there are also, in the South, a series of very sharp, column race riots. That's what there was, and the North hears about all this. Okay, then the Congress comes back into session in December of 65. When it comes back into session, what it says is, these southern states, which have supposedly been brought back into the Union by the President Andrew Johnson, will not immediately be accepted. So when in the Congress the clerk reads the roll of the states, and you come, for example, to Alabama, the first one, see, alphabetically, you don't read their name. So none of their congressmen and senators are going to be seated. They simply pass them over. Then they set up a committee of joint reconstruction of members from the House and the Senate to see what direction Reconstruction should take in the South. Okay, what the Congress is insisting upon, it's dominated pretty much by Republicans, not Democrats. Don't confuse this with today, but the party of Abe Lincoln, okay? And what they are going to want now is, they say, what the South ought to do before it comes into the Union is pass a Civil Rights Act. And then the second thing is to reestablish for another year the Freedmen's Bureau. See, what the Freedmen's Bureau was is that federal institution, the first federal social institution to take care of the 4+ million ex-slaves who are now freedmen. The leaders of the Congress think that Andrew Johnson is going to pass it, but what he does is he vetoes both of them. He vetoes the Freedmen's Bureau bill and vetoes the Civil Rights Bill. Okay. What's going to happen then? There is a congressional election, and it's a very decisive one. The Republicans and the radical Republicans get complete control of the Congress, and they have enough votes to override a presidential veto. So what is passed then? A Civil Rights Bill is passed, and in addition to that, the Freedmen's Bureau Bill, which is going to take care of the freedmen, see, the 4 million ex-slaves, is also repassed. Okay, then what Congress does under radical Reconstruction is, they say, any southern, well, this way, what they're going to do now with the southern seceded states is they're going to divide it into 5 military districts, and there's going to be a major general over each one of these 5 districts in the South. They will supervise the setting up of the voting roll. And on the voting roll now, you will have, now, by the way, at that time in our country, no women vote. But you will have enrolled all blacks in the South, along with whites, but excluded will be some of the key leaders of the Confederacy. Not many are excluded, but blacks must be included on the roll. Then, a state in the South has got to have a constitutional convention. And in this constitutional convention, they must adopt not only the 13th Amendment, which frees the slave, but also the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment, first of all, what that did is said any southern state which does not let a black man vote, their congressional delegation will be reduced that much. What the 15th Amendment did is went beyond that and said that the black male will have the vote. And no southern state can come back into the Union until that state and constitutional convention ratifies 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. Okay, now these three amendments are in our history called the Radical Amendments. Now, why in all the world that should be radical in the context of American history, to me, says an awful lot about our history. Why should that be a radical idea? See? Says a lot about our history totally. But anyhow, that's radical reconstruction. So what's going to happen then is the black male will take his role in Southern politics. Now, when you come to the end of the period of Reconstruction, by the way, Ulysses S. Grant is pretty much president in the 1870s for two terms after Andrew Johnson is gone. Comes the election of 1877. In that election, it's a very disputed election. The Republican candidate is Rutherford B. Hayes. The Democratic candidate is Samuel J. Tilden. What happens in that election is, actually, Tilden seems to have more votes, and that would mean that he would become president of the United States, not a Republican president, the party of Lincoln. But it so happens that three states in the South have disputed electoral votes. In other words, a Democratic faction, which is anti-black, and a Republican faction, which is pro-black in this context. And by the way, I always remind you, don't equate this with 20th century politics. But there are enough votes there to determine who will be president of the United States. So what happens is a compromise is made. That's the compromise of 1877. And in this compromise, what happens is the agreement is made that troops will be withdrawn from the South, and basically Southern whites will be allowed to control politics again in the South. And what will happen as a result is the agreement will be made that Rutherford B. Hayes will get the disputed Southern electoral votes. So he has 185, while Tilden has 184. Okay. So he's president on the compromise. But this really is, in terms of my interpretation, and a lot of historians on whose back I kind of ride, is the abandonment of the freedmen in terms of national policy with the end of Reconstruction. Now, you do not have the coming of Jim Crow quite yet. Now, remember what Jim Crow is. Jim Crow is the legal segregation of the races in the South. Legal. Okay? That really does not come till the 1890s. But in the rest of the 1880s, what pretty much happens is the whites can control the vote by intimidating the freedmen. Okay. Now that, just in brief, is kind of a quick thumbnail sketch of the period of Reconstruction. But now what's important to remember is that 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments are in the Constitution like a time bomb, ticking. And it's going to take a long, long time for the implications of it to come out. When does it come out? 1954, the Civil Rights Revolution. Would there have been such a thing without the 14th and 15th Amendments? So it's there. It's not really deeply respected for a long period in our history, but it's there. For a right time, 54, see, which is, well, how many years later, from 1890 roughly to 1954, it's a 60-year period where Jim Crow is fully in the saddle. Well, now, anyhow, what happens is, in the period after Reconstruction, okay, when you get to the 80s and the 90s and then into this century, what happens is many historians and the American people in a general way look back at the period of Reconstruction and say, what was wrong with Reconstruction? Why did Reconstruction fail? It failed because the preposterous thing was done, namely giving the freedman, the black man, the vote. Right? And that is what is seen as being the bad thing. Pretty much until down to World War II. So there's your situation. Now, what happens is then, in the period after Reconstruction, pretty much down and through the 20s, there is the myth, all kinds of myths that have to do with the freedmen. Now I'll tell you slowly what this is. The hidden freedmen. Or what was the true freedman like when you get beyond the myths of Reconstruction, which are a later projection back upon the period of Reconstruction? Right? Well, five myths in the Reconstruction era. Okay, the first one is this. So when the freedman is freed, how did they act? Okay, now think of Blazing Day. Think of the stereotypes there. What's the key stereotype? Sambo? Sambo image? That the black is kind of like a fawning child, childlike, over-emotional, kind of the male as being kind of an eternal male child, kind of this notion, see? The Sambo image. Well, you project this back on the freedmen then and say, how was it when the freedmen were free? It was the day of Jubilee. Well, what's the day of Jubilee? This is the notion that when the freedmen, the child, it's the Sambo child, suddenly has his freedom, and they all go around shouting hallelujah. Hallelujah. Well, of course they shouted hallelujah, but not in this sense. So, actually now, since 54 in the Civil Rights era, when historians analyze a lot of the documents from this period, and right now I'm just reading a real fat book on this period, which deals with a lot of these sources, what was it that the freedmen really wanted? It wasn't so much for them a day of jubilee where they're just shouting and rejoicing in an emotional kind of way. When, say, the Yankee captain comes to the plantation and says, "You're free," and they all shout hallelujah, or the master maybe tells them, gathered in front of the mansion, "You're free," and they all shout hallelujah in the great day of jubilee. But rather, what was it? Well, that they were farmers. Most of them were farmers, tilling the soil. What they were concerned about was their cabin, which they always had, and the patch of private land which they had associated with their cabin, and to have clothes and to feed their children. Or in other words, simply getting along with life. You find very little in the writings of those freedmen who wrote about this and later on talked about this, talking about being childlike in jubilation. Right? Of course, they were glad they're free, for Pete's sake. But see, the day of jubilee, kind of the irresponsible child responding to some goodie or something like that. Okay? Well, that's the first myth. That Sambo image. Okay? What's the second one? The myth of the Exodus. And I remember years ago when I first began to study all this business seriously, one of the key notions of 19th century supposedly scientific thought was that since the black is supposedly this Sambo, that if they do not have the guiding hand of the master and the mistress, and they're left on their own, quite literally, they will become extinct. Okay? Well, you've got a lot of that with this notion of the myth of the Exodus. What's the myth of the Exodus? This notion. Freedom comes, civil war is over with, they have their freedom, and what do? They begin to cut themselves loose and rove across the land. Kind of mindlessly, heedlessly, simply taken off in a huge exodus. Well, actually, what's going on? Where Yankee armies came, there you had streams of refugees. That's not an exodus. That's responding to the Yankee army in your environs. Okay? And what are a lot of them doing? You find this in all of the literature. They are seeking their family to try to reunite themselves after their families have been separated. This is no exodus. Furthermore, demographically, when studies are made of this, where did most of the ex-slaves, now the freedmen, stay? They stayed on the plantation where they had lived all their life. Okay. But now what happened? Since they are no longer slaves, what did they do? And by the way, a lot of this was guided by the Freedmen's Bureau that was supposed to protect them. Often they did it well, often they did not do it too well. This is to guarantee the contract now, labor contract, made by the ex-slave with his or her former master or mistress. See, contracting to labor on the former master's land for pay. So that's what's going on. Actually, when does the big exodus come? And it's a massive exodus. And we'll talk about this maybe in 2 weeks or so, after 1900, when the African Americans came to the North in a flood tide. That's when you have the exodus. But that's an economic exodus looking for economic opportunity in the North, in the industrialized North. Well, there's the second myth. But see, the period, roughly from the 1890s, pretty much down to World War II, you've got these myths running around. But see what the background to this is. The trouble with Reconstruction is that it was a misguided experiment in giving the black male the vote, in giving him too much political power, and trying to force social equality on the poor Southern whites. That's what's going on. Okay, so what's the third myth? The third myth is the myth of the prodigal son. Well, of course, a lot of you are familiar with the scriptural story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son gets his inheritance and he goes off into a far country and spends it on wine, woman, and song, and who knows what not all, and then comes to his senses and comes back home to father and says, "Father, I have sinned and no longer am worthy to be called your son. Well, son, I forgive you. Come back home." See, that notion. See, that the freedman was a prodigal son. First, many of them take off. See, that would have to do with the myth of the Exodus. But then they find they cannot make their way, so they come back home to the former master. Kind of with hat in hand. Bad idea. But actually, what is it? What most of them are looking for is simply where it is they have lived their entire life, their cabin, their roots, and their patch. Or the phrase that is usually used, they come back to the mud sill of their cabin. That's where their roots are. They're not prodigals at all, trying to make their way as best they can in terms of what they had known and the kind of future they would wish to make. So there's the myth of the prodigal son. Now the next one, and I'm sure you probably heard about this, the myth of 40 acres and a mule. Or this notion that in the community of the freedmen, the foolish notion was running around that the federal government had promised them land, 40 acres, and along with the 40 acres, each one would get a mule, so they could become independent farmers. Well, as far as the myth of 40 acres and a mule is concerned, that's no myth. Congress voted them the land. And this land was to be given to them from land which was taken from expropriated land from former masters who had abandoned their land during the war. Right? Now, actually, where this started, and this is real interesting reading for any of you who want to go into this. See, early in the war, the Yankees conquered first the Sea Island. That would be off the coast of South Carolina and some off North Carolina. These were huge plantations. The Yankee armies were there. And what they did simply, see, the masters ran away, so it's abandoned land. Then what they did is they had a huge experiment there, and the former slaves there were given the soil, were given the land, and it became theirs legally. And this was going to be applied more generally across the South to give them a grub stake. See, now what is freedom without economic wherewithal? The two have got to go hand in glove. 40 acres and a mule along with your freedom. See, now one of the tragedies of Reconstruction is that the way it ends up is with nominal freedom without economic wherewithal. That's part of the tragedy that's going to happen later on when you come to the late 1880s and 1890s and then into this century. But this was no myth. That was an act of Congress. Now, earlier in the hour, you remember I said that what did Lyndon Johnson do in the summer of 1865? He had this liberal pardoning policy for Southern planters, and they come and say, we have sinned and wish to be forgiven. He says, you're forgiven, and you get your land back. So who's kicked off the land? The freedmen are, who thought it was theirs. And they have no legal recourse at that point. Land is taken away from them, which had been promised. Okay, so there you've got that. Okay, now these four myths here, the myth of Jubilee, the myth of the Exodus, and the myth of the prodigal son and 40 acres and a mule, all of these go with the Sambo myth. Okay? Now there's another one. Watch this last one. And by the way, usually in the white mind, through this period, and generally in American history, I think it's true, there are two counterbalancing images with regard to the African American. One is Sambo, and the other is Lazengame Nat. Nat. Not Jack, but Nat. These two. Okay? Now, during the period of Reconstruction, what you pretty much have in terms of balance is the Sambo figure seems to dominate. But when you come to the period a little bit later, from 90 down through 1920, it's more the opposite, Nat. Or the Sambo image versus the devil image, these two. Now this last one, or devil, you know, say that savage, Sambo savage. Okay, the myth of a savage. Now, what is that one? Well, when during the period of Reconstruction, the freedmen demand what? Along with their freedom, equality. Okay? What presumption? to demand equality with the whites, which means social integration. The very fact that they demand freedom, and along with freedom, equality. And that's symbolized in the vote, see, for the black male. No, that is savage, danger. See. So this is another one of those myth symbols. And they all kind of go together. But you see what you really got here. When you boil it down, what really is it? They want to be farmers, they want cabins, they want clothes, they want a decent contract. They're looking for their family. They want to settle down on the cabin patch that they've been in their whole life. They have expectations for land to go along with their freedom, which Congress promised. And they demand freedom and equality. Right? Now, when Reconstruction is over with, you project back on this the notion that the failure of Reconstruction was that it was a radical experiment in giving to the black, the freedmen, along with freedom, equality, and first-class citizenship. Right? So that's the way I interpret this. And this pretty much is the way historians in the contemporary mode interpret it. But it has not always been so in our history. Well, I just spent a little time on this, not so much. The only reason why I'm so full of this is what I wrote my dissertation on. Okay, now you can take the histories that have been written on the period of Reconstruction. That's what I did. Okay, now here's the timeline. 1900 to today. 1900 to 1980. And what you can pretty well trace is how generally the American massive public views the race issue is pretty much going to shape how Reconstruction is interpreted. So you can say, and by the way, the sheet I gave you there is something I wrote, from my doctoral work, which you can read at your leisure to kind of figure this out. Okay, now the period from 1900 down to almost 1930. In terms of American social values, sharply racist. Not only against African Americans, but other immigrant groups as well. Roman Catholics, boy, did they get it in the neck. Other kinds of immigrants. But now, the school that dominates during this period is called the Dunning School. See, now what that school says is that the tragedy of Reconstruction is that it was an illegitimate burden upon the Southern white. And what did you have during this period? During Reconstruction, you had the domination of Southern politics by Yankee carpetbaggers and Southern scalawags. See, that would be Southern white traitors who joined the Yankee carpetbaggers along with the black male vote. And this together is an oppression upon the white. Basically that idea. Well, of course you take the same kind of historical material, and then what comes from 1920 to 1940, now those of you who know more about history know that during this period, this is the period of the Depression. Well, during the period of the Depression, what happens now, and this is when a real shift comes, the Dunning School is out. And what pretty much happens here is they say what the Civil War had primarily to do with is a capitalistic North versus an agrarian South, and the coming of economic capitalism to the country. That's what the Civil War was all about. And the whole question of race is no longer so key and central. So it's a little bit changed, the interpretation. Okay, then you come to civil rights era possible. Well, so here from 50 to 60, and really beyond, this is the civil rights era. This is where Martin Luther King comes. And then you have what? Neo-revisionism, or in other words, a revising of this revisionism in this way, that the period of Reconstruction was not a total failure, that it had some long-range success, and what the long-range success is, that in spite of the fact that you have this whole period of Jim Crow from 1890 down to World War II, yet in the Constitution you have those radical amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th, which along with American idealism will not let the American conscience rest. Okay? So I think what you would say there is that Reconstruction was a qualified failure because it abandoned the freedmen, ultimately, but in the long run made possible, in a different age, a change, civil rights era. Of course, now how much change actually took place since the civil rights era is another question. But it did make that change possible. Okay, then you come to the 60s, and, I kind of fit here, but somewhat here. New Left. What the New Left period said, see, that's the period of Vietnam in the late 60s. What this period says is that American institutions have basically failed, and that is the failure of Reconstruction, that American institutions failed. Right. So it's a little sharper than neo-revisionism. Okay, then you come to the period where? Beyond, you come to the 80s, down to today, but in the 80s, what do we have? That's the period of Ronald Reagan. Conservatism. Richard Nixon. Conservatism. So this is reflected then also in the way Reconstruction is reinterpreted. How is it reinterpreted? That you kind of look at the period of Reconstruction in terms of conservative continuity with the long stream of American history. And you don't see Reconstruction as being a unique projection, but just part of a continuing story, kind of that way. Of course, now where we go from here is kind of another question. But see, now, for example, when you think of a movie like Gone with the Wind, where does Gone with the Wind fit? Back in here. The stereotypes you have in there are the stereotypes of the Dunning School. Pray tell, what does that have to do with historical interpretation? Plenty. Right? It's a reflection of that. Obviously a classic. But how do you interpret history, say, that way? So anyhow, I don't know, I can't help it. My gut sits here with neo-revisionism. So you got to kind of see where this you fit. Well, okay.